Thank you very much, Rabbi Rubin. And thank you very much for having me today as well. Raise your hand if your grandparents or great-grandparents came from Poland or from Galicia, from Eastern Europe. Poland or Galicia? Like Hungary and the Ukraine and all that. Russia? Yeah? So, could you imagine that 100 years ago, in Galicia and in Poland, guess how many, not including Lithuanian Poland, only Hasidic Poland. In Hasidic Poland and in Galicia, guess how many big yeshivos there were? And we think about Poland and Galicia as being, you know, the greatest areas where all the Hasidim lived. How many big yeshivos do you think there were in Poland and Galicia? Yeah?
Two.
Anyone have a different number? Anyone on this side? Yeah?
One.
Maybe one. Anybody else? Yeah?
Three.
Okay. There were zero. 100 years ago, in Poland and in Galicia, there were no yeshivos. People learned, there were certainly makomos of Torah, certainly places where people learned very, very intently, but there were no big yeshivos in the way that we conceive of them today. In Lita, in Lithuania, they started all these big yeshivos, you know, Volozhin and the Mir, and big yeshivas that you hear about still today. But in the Hasidic world, there were no big yeshivas. And who can think of why there were no big yeshivas in the Hasidic world? Why do you think there were no big yeshivas? Yeah, what's one possible reason?
There wasn't enough money to make them.
Okay, that's right. So one reason is that there wasn't enough money around to make the big yeshivas, yeah?
No one built them.
There wasn't one person who took the initiative to build the yeshiva, yeah?
Anti-Semitism,
maybe. That wasn't really, that's a good idea. But that's not the main reason why there were no yeshivas. Anybody else? So, those two reasons are really the reason why. So number one, there wasn't enough money. In fact, there was so little money for yeshivos that there were little, you know, people, there were cheders, there were elementary schools and middle schools for young children to go to. And once they graduated, once they left those schools, they would learn privately with their teachers, or they would learn in the shtiebels. There were shtiebels where people would learn. And there usually would be somebody that would give a shiur once in a while. But there were no dormitories or anything like that. There was not enough money for that. In fact, could you imagine what they did instead of dormitories? Because everybody, all the young men had to get together in one place to learn. So instead of having dormitories, they made a deal with the shop owners in Galicia and in Poland. You see, in the streets, there were a lot of thieves and robbers. And the shop owners had to pay for security guards at night. Otherwise, thieves and robbers would break into their stores every night and steal things. And so they made a deal with the yeshiva students. And that was that they would sleep in the stores, in the streets. So all the yeshiva students in these areas would sleep in stores, in the shops, in order that the thieves and robbers wouldn't come at night. And then the shop owners let them stay there for free because they didn't have to pay for security guards. In fact, Rabbi Meir Shapiro, when he first proposed Yeshivas Chachmei Lublin, which we'll speak about momentarily, when he first proposed it, he said, up until now, we in the Hasidic world have to be thankful for all the thieves and robbers, because without the thieves and robbers, we wouldn't be able to have yeshivas. So that's number one. There wasn't enough money. Number two, there wasn't one person. There weren't people who would go around and build big yeshivos. And part of that had to do with the fact that there were so many different Hasidic groups. There was Babov, and there was Bells, and there was, a lot of Hasidic groups. I'm sorry?
No.
Yeah. Many, many different Hasidic groups. The Ger Hasidim. So many different groups. And each group wasn't big enough to really have its own large yeshiva. But they also didn't get together to form one large yeshiva. And so every Hasidic group held its own shtiebel, and the Rebbe of that Hasidic group would give shiur once in a while, but because he was a Rebbe, his main job his main role was to be a community leader for all of his chassidim. He couldn't focus his attention just on the yeshiva. What do you think were some of the negative consequences of that system, where you couldn't really have one teacher who focused on the yeshiva? Yeah?
There was no yeshiva.
So there was no yeshiva, that's right. But even in the shtiebels. In these shtiebels, you know, if you happened to be an Ilui, a very, very, you know, bright person, then you were able to learn very well. All the Sfarim that we have from that period, the Chidushei Harim, which is the Rebbe from Ger, or the Beis Yitzchak, Rabbi Yitzchak Shmelkis, all these people that learned at this time, they didn't learn yeshivas, but they were exceptionally bright. And they had wonderful teachers, and they were able to learn from those teachers. But if you weren't, you know, really the top echelon, really the top kind of student, then you didn't really have anybody that cared for you, you didn't have anybody that led you in the right path to teach you and to help you learn Torah at a higher level. And so that's what bothered Rabbi Meir Shapiro. Rabbi Meir Shapiro was born in Bukovina, in Galicia. And he was born in the Hasidic world, but he happened to be born into a very wealthy family who was able to hire Malamdin. They were able to hire great teachers for him. And he never had that upbringing of having to live in the storefront or anything like that. When he saw it, he was in shock. And Rabbi Meir Shapiro grew to be an Ilui. He was a very, very bright person. He was known as the Ilui of Shatz because that's where he was learning. And he was a wonderful speaker and a wonderful orator. He was able to, you know, he was like a magnet. He was able to get everybody's attention and to teach in such a way that everybody listened and everybody was able to learn. So much so that in 1922 he joined the Polish Parliament, and he represented the Jewish population in Poland in the Polish Parliament. And he was the Rav of a few cities.
In other words, he was a senator besides being a rabbi in the shul.
Right.
He was a senator in the state house in the Polish.
Right. He was basically a senator, and he was able to look out for Jewish interests, for the interests of the Jewish people, by being that representative over there. And he joined, of course, the Agudas Yisrael, and he became a very active leader in the Aguda. And in 1923, the Aguda held its first World Jewish Congress, a big convention in Vienna, in Austria, for everybody. At that convention, Rabbi Meir Shapiro, who at the time was the rabbi of Sanok in Galicia, and the representative in the Polish government. At that time, he recommended two things at the World Jewish Congress. Number one, the Daf Yomi, which we know about. And number two, the establishment of a great yeshiva in Poland, specifically for Hasidim. It was a revolutionary idea, because up until then, all the different Hasidim didn't get together and make one big thing together with unity. Everybody had their own yeshiva, everybody had their own shtiebel, and their own world. And in fact, there was a little bit of a fear. You see, if you were from a Belzer family, you didn't want to send your kid, even though the Baba of Yeshiva might have been a better yeshiva. I don't really know which yeshiva was the better yeshiva. But even if the Baba of Yeshiva happened to be a better yeshiva, if you were a Belzer, there wasn't any way you were sending your kid to a Baba of Yeshiva, because you wanted your child to be brought up and to be taught the Belzer Hasidus, and vice versa, and so on and so forth. And so if there happened to be a wonderful Belzer Rebbe, or Belzer teacher, then if you were in Belz, you were lucky. But if you were in Babov, you were unlucky. So Rabbi Meir Shapiro got the agreement of all of the Hasidic Rebbes before he went to the World Jewish Congress, because he knew that it would be a controversial idea. And he said, let's build one big yeshiva to send all of the future community leaders of the Hasidic world, so that we can get all of the best and brightest, all the best teachers together, and we can teach them, so that we can pass on Torah in a more organized fashion, similar to what they were doing in Lithuania. But of course, the Hasidim couldn't send their kids to the yeshivas in Lithuania. They would never have allowed it in Lithuania. So Rabbi Meir Shapiro got the agreement of Agudas Yisrael, even though the Lithuanian and Russia Yeshiva were opposed. But he got, they were opposed, yeah. They said, why do you need another, see,
the, while you were saying this, I was wondering how the Lithuanians.
Yeah, the Lithuanians were opposed to it because they said, what do you need another big yeshiva for? Send them all to the Mir.
And how about the German?
I don't know. But I know that in Lithuania they were opposed. They said, why don't you send your kids to
Mir?
Now, Chabad was always separate from all the other. It wasn't always that Chabad was in Crown Heights and all the other Hasidim were in Borough Park. Yeah. It was always the case that Chabad was pretty separate from the other Hasidim because of distance. And so the history of Chabad, you know, plays out in a very different way than the history of the rest of the Hasidic world. It's not just the difference in the kind of hat, you know. He got the agreement of all the rabbis. And he specifically picked Lublin. Who can guess maybe why? Why do you think Rabbi Meir Shapiro picked Lublin to be the yeshiva? Yeah, Shira?
It's central,
maybe. Yeah.
It's one of the largest cities in Poland.
It was one of the largest cities in Poland, yeah.
So
very close to that answer, actually. Lublin had a history of having a lot of Talmidei Chachamim. The Maharshal was in Lublin, and the Maharam Lublin was in Lublin. And so you could really call it Yeshivas Chachmei Lublin, because there was a long history of Chachmei Lublin, of scholars of Talmidei Chachamim.
I didn't realize that. I thought Chachmei Lublin meant that the students are Chachamim. It means historically.
It means historically Lublin was Chachamim. That's where it came from. They couldn't call it right. So historically, there were a lot of Chachamim in Lublin. And so they established it there in Lublin. And they got a place because of Rabbi Meir Shapiro's connections in the government. They were able to get a plot of land for the yeshiva. Very centrally in Lublin. I mean, imagine a big yeshiva in like Times Square or something. You know, it's very centrally located in Lublin. And in 1924, they set the cornerstone. And there were there are different estimates. Some people say it was 20,000 people. Anywhere between 20,000 and 50,000 people were there for the big ceremony of laying the cornerstone. And it wasn't just Jews. I mean, the Hasidic world came from all over Galicia and Poland for this big ceremony of laying the cornerstone. But so did government representatives from Poland. Everybody was there. It was a huge event. They laid the cornerstone. Unfortunately, there still was some trouble finding money because it was all well and good that the World Jewish Congress agreed we should build a yeshiva. Didn't mean they have the money to build the yeshiva. And so Rabbi Meir Shapiro had to leave his rabbinic positions in 1928. That's why he left the Polish government, because he had to dedicate his full energy to fundraising for the yeshiva. And he came to America for 10 months, traveling all around the country to try to raise money for Yeshivas Chachmei Lublin. And unfortunately, he actually wasn't so successful. He was not able to raise so much money in America for a few reasons, mainly because the wealthy Jews in America, by and large, were the Germans, and it wasn't the people from the Hasidic world. And so when he was able, he was able to speak very well to those that had Hasidic ancestors, but he wasn't able to really speak so well to the Germans. I mean, the Germans didn't let him speak in their institutions. And so he really wasn't so successful. In the end, they took out a lot of loans, and they were able to build the yeshiva. And in 1930, they finally opened the yeshiva with 10,000 people there.
And so that's
6 years after the approval of the World Jewish Congress. They built the yeshiva. There were six stories, 110 different rooms, a big base medrash, and Rabbi Meir Shapiro gave a big opening shiur, and then the yeshiva took off. Yeah?
Do you know how many square feet there were?
I don't know how many square feet. That's a good question. It was a big yeshiva. You can still go visit it today in Lublin. I'll tell you what happened to it. So, it was a huge success, and it did things that no other yeshiva did. The reason why it was so unique was that Rabbi Meir Shapiro had traveled the Jewish world. And he had gotten Darchei Halimud, he had gotten ways of learning from all the different places, from Lithuania, from the Galicianers, and from the Polish world. You know, each area had their own way of studying Talmud. In Lithuania, they were very sharp and very, you know, particular about learning things very much in depth. And in Poland, they were sharp about what's called pilpul, They made distinctions. These are all things that you learn with time. And in Galicia, they did Bikias. In Galicia, they learned so much Gemara that everybody had to know a lot. And so Rabbi Meir Shapiro's goal was to combine all the different kinds of learning in one yeshiva. That's why the people that came out of that yeshiva, like Rav Hirschsprung, are Talmidei Chachamim of another caliber that really never came out of other yeshivas, because they had that unique combination of all the styles in one place. Unfortunately, Rabbi Meir Shapiro fell ill with typhus in 1933, and he passed away at a very young age. He was 46 years old, so very, very young. And
his yeshiva was open when he was there only for 3 years.
Only for 3 years, yeah. He only led it for 3 years. And then somebody else, one of the Rebbeim, took over. In fact, when the other, there was another, the next sort of Rebbe that was there was a Kabbalist, and he was very mystical. And he was not really such a Talmudist. And the yeshiva took a turn. The people who were very close to Rav Meir Shapira felt that the yeshiva was not really going in the right direction once Rav Meir Shapira left. Because it was sort of, they were studying other things. In any event, of course, we all know what happened in Poland in the late 1930s. In 1939, the Nazis came and destroyed the yeshiva. They raided the yeshiva. They took all the books out. There were something like 5,000 books in the yeshiva. Took all the books and burned them. And there were cries from the Jewish community in Lublin, so much so that the Nazis brought in a marching band to play music loudly so you wouldn't hear all the cries from the Jewish community in Lublin. And they destroyed it. And then after World War II, that building became a hospital and a medical school. In 2003, because of an agreement with the Polish government, the building was returned to the Jewish community. It became a shul. The Beis Medrash in the Yeshivas Chachmei Lublin became a shul. And the plan was to turn the rest of the building into a museum of Hasidus. Unfortunately, that didn't really pan out, and it's now a five-star hotel in Lublin called Hotel Ilan. Which you can all Hotel Ilan, it's called. I think it's a kosher hotel. I think so. I don't remember for sure, but I'm pretty sure it's a kosher hotel, specifically meant for Jewish tourists in that area. And so you know, unfortunately, it went from being, you know, it was only a yeshiva for 9 years, which is you know, remarkable, because it is such an important yeshiva, and it really paved the way for the unity among the Hasidic groups that we have today. That didn't exist before Rabbi Meir Shapiro wanted to build this yeshiva. One important point that I missed was that Rabbi Meir Shapiro was very, very intent on not teaching any one kind of Hasidus, because if he did, then nobody would agree to send to go to the yeshiva. He taught all the different kinds of Hasidus in the yeshiva, and there was no pressure put on anybody to follow one path or another path. It was a very, what's called a laissez-faire approach, which meant that he taught Hasidus in general, from the Baal Shem Tov and other sort of, you know, Hasidic teachings from before all of the fragmentation. And so any different kind of Hasidic student can go to the yeshiva and not feel pressured or not feel like they were being taught one or the other. It helped that he was kind of a mixture of all the different Hasidus too. He didn't really belong to one Hasidic group or the other. So that was very, very helpful in that case. But that's the story of Yeshivas Chachmei Lublin. You know, we have Rabbi Rubin is, as you know, is a Talmud of Rabbi Hirschsprung, who himself was a Talmud of Yeshivas Chachmei Lublin. My great-grandfather, who I never met, but I know that he attended the yeshiva as well before the war. And so we still have products of that yeshiva world today.
You think, who did they take over, the elite?
They
or it
did.
Was like open like today that, you know, anybody goes to Meir or Lubavitch?
No, it was really the elite. You had to know 200 block Gemara by heart to enter the yeshiva. So that was a requirement. If you had to pass an oral exam, faher, where they tested you on 200 block Gemara, and you had to know it by heart in order to enter the yeshiva. It was the goal. Rabbi Meir Shapira basically felt that there was no one, there was no place where the best teachers in the Hasidic world would go. Because if, again, if he was a Belzer, he would only teach the Belzer Hasidim. So he said, we got to gather all the best teachers to make sure that the next generation of Rebbeim in the Hasidic world are also top-notch and not just by chance, you know, if, you know, and not just, you know, leave it to chance as to who would be the top.
And how many students do they have again?
I'm not sure.
He opened with 60 students. But then later, he had about 200.
But what do you think the end was, most of them? I mean, Rabbi Hirschman obviously survived the Holocaust, but probably the majority did.
Well, like Rabbi Wozner, the famous Rabbi Wozner. He's a continuation of that. He was there.
And he was the Rosh Yeshiva of the of Yeshivas Chachmei Lublin in Bnei Brak as well, Rav Wozner, because they continued the Yeshiva in Bnei Brak.
We know that a certain number of them, not a lot, like 30 or something, how many?
Were in Shanghai.
Were in Shanghai even more, so that's like...
That's still not the majority. Probably.
Probably.
Yeah. What happened was, this is important to know about Shanghai, I'll just put that part in, that in Shanghai there were three yeshivas. Beer had 300 bukkah. That was the biggest. There was a smaller Lubavitch yeshiva of about 30 boys, and a smaller yeshiva Katan Lulim of about 30 boys. The reason for that is because the map, the geography, Mir is very close to Kovno, where Sugihara issued visas. So the Mir yeshiva just picked up from the town they were in Lithuania and moved over 100%. The boys of Yeshiva Katan Lublin struggled across Poland, walking through Poland to get to Kovno to see Sugihara. So half of them or more of them fell by the wayside walking there and everything that was going on during the war. So that's what happened a week ago. Did you hear the story happened a week ago? the Hamadiyah from there to the Russian side of, and Henry described it was how they went on through a river, they waded through a river.
Wow.
Okay, so that's, we all remember Amir Shapiro, everyone is welcome to a little Nasha.
Okay. Before we go, I just want to add something I just discovered yesterday. So today is also Zion Cheshvan, and that's the, it says in the Mishnah that the Jews waited in Israel to say St. Talmud.
Oh, I got a wonderful question. Phil Chandler is now in Israel.